Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit with my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, welcome to Yin Radio. Today's show is called Artistic Inspiration. It's a collection of stories from artists, painters, potters, collagists, creative people who I came across in Moscow, Idaho. But they don't all come from Moscow. We're going to start with Maori artist June Grant. She's from New Zealand. Then to Rebecca York from the countryside in North Idaho. Next is Moscow resident Jennifer Rod, and she pays homage to another local artist, Ginevra Sloan. And Jennifer Rod is followed by her sister, potter Rebecca Rod, who shares her artistic and spiritual inspiration from the Great Mother. On today's show, I am featuring the music of Art in Manila. So let's start there with Set the Woods on Fire.
We make things better. Make things hard. A shelter of sorrow grows in the dark.
That was Art in Manila. They're kicking off our show called Artistic Inspiration on this Yin Radio program. We're going to go to installment number one. Survival Symbols. This features June Northcroft Grant. Artists work with symbols. And in Art History 101, you're going to learn about meanings of symbols. Like a halo indicates holiness and purity. A cave symbolizes the origin of life or resurrection. An owl means knowledge. Fruit represents sexual passion, and an egg, fertility. Some symbols are more obscure than that. For instance, ivy as a symbol of eternity, or a bundle of twigs meaning unity. But symbols work because they're universal or they're cultural. They relate to a culture's culture's mythologies, the beliefs that define that culture. So when Maori artist June Grant talks about her art to Americans, she has to take time to explain the symbology of her art.
These are manaia, and manaia in context of our meeting house are usually around the heads of our warriors. They look, in the meeting house, they look like a lovely curvilinear design that swirls around the head of the ancestors. When you look closely, you'll see the beak of a bird and the eye, and the body will be serpentine, so it looks like a little bird man figure. These are guardian figures, and they're around the head of the person because the head is the most sacred part of the body. So in the context of the meeting house, the warriors are all surrounded by these manaia, which are guardians, guarding their brains and their mental ability.
June Grant is a painter who works in the bold graphic styles of the Maori. It's based on traditional Pacific tribal art with bold lines and bright colors, and it's laden with symbology. Her paintings are not really concerned with realism, but with telling a story. And June visited the Northwest as an artist in residence at the Evergreen State College in spring of this year. Her presentation on May 28th was about her art, and in particular about the collection called The Journey. It's a series of four paintings that tell a story. It's a story of survival. June Grant has survived breast cancer.
This is called The Discovery. And this is the first of the paintings that I did in the series. And this is me in New York. In 2003, I was in New York with a friend, and we were looking at doing marketing up there. The Mercedes building, is it Chrysler building, was there. And so that's, I wear that as my tiara. So this pattern here represents the sea, Moana Nui, the Pacific Ocean, and there are two hammerhead shark forms there. And the reason this painting was significant to me was that I was lying in bed in New York with my hands on my chest watching a television documentary about, in fact it was a news item, and it was about a young woman in Utah had gone missing. Her name was Elizabeth Smart. And they couldn't find her. And I was lying there and I felt a lump in my breast, and I thought, is that a lump? No, that's not a lump. But the reason I could always recall Elizabeth Smart when I thought about the time that I felt, so it was a defining moment in my life. I thought something strange has happened, but I still dismissed it. And so the painting is about me in New York making a discovery. I found the lump in July, and it was October before I even went to the doctor, because I thought, we don't get cancer in our family, because we just, you know, we don't get cancer. And I didn't know anybody else with breast cancer, and there was no reason to believe that it wasn't just a normal little lump of some sort. So when the doctor, after the biopsy, said, I'm afraid it is cancer, I thought, who? I just stepped outside of my body and I thought, I wonder who he's talking to. He can't be talking to me. So until you have the surgery, you don't know how bad it is. And I felt as if I was drowning and I couldn't breathe properly. And so I was always breathing into the top of my chest. I went into a automated mode of just getting on with life and being happy and taking lots of photos in case I wasn't going to be around for long and all of those sorts of things. But so these paintings were painted in the cancer lodge when I had 6 weeks of chemotherapy and radiation. And I didn't know what else to do. And I thought, I can do this. I can paint this last set of images that my children will be able to realize, you know, what sort of a journey that I was on.
June needed some guardians at this time in her life. Do you remember the manaia that she spoke about earlier, the serpentine bird men guardian figures? So after her discovery of breast cancer, she needed those guardians, and she put the manaia in her paintings and many other symbols about life and death and connections.
So here I am. with Manaya holding me to the ground. And this is the second painting, which talks about the surgery. So I painted all the things that were really important. And one of the things was, well, obviously everything's important when you're dying, but the canoe denotes where I'm from. I'm a canoe person. Our people travelled from a homeland in Hawaiki to New Zealand in the year 500 AD. And we are obviously travellers. We travel by the stars and by the currents. And this denotes, this is that moko chin pattern. So it denotes my matrilineal ancestry. But it also, that pattern's the owl. So you can see the owl there, the eyes and the beak. So this is the owl. So this talks about everything I hold dear. This is about who I am and where I'm from. These are the petroglyph images again, which talks about my ancestors making their marks on the land. And this is the big Manaya. I painted a really huge guardian because I really needed something to help me through the battle, and I really wanted something from the spirit world that was going to... So even if I painted it, it was in thought. It was like, I need some help here. And so typically in the meeting house, the figures are... they have images between the legs, usually one, and it's just a simple symbol of life carrying on. And so I painted my four children here. These are my four little children. They're not so little now, and their children. So this was about this was a story about me in myth and legend and in somebody's mind leaving something behind for my children. The feather is the huia feather, and the huia feather denoted leadership, but it also suggested values, that what you hold dear to your heart is what you take on to the next world, and it's what you leave behind for your children. So the feather was about retaining things of value and importance.
Between the discovery and the second painting, June came to a sense of reality. Then she moved on to the experience of dealing with the cancer on a physical level, because she started chemotherapy. She had to deal with death, which was suddenly all around her, but first she had to deal with losing her hair. And for a Native woman with hair down to her knees, this was no small issue.
And I thought, how am I going to cope with chemotherapy? Because you go bald, don't you? And I said to the surgeon. He said, yes, you do. I said, is there any way out of it? Is there other ways we can do it? He said, you can choose not to have chemo. And I spoke with my family and I said, what do I do? And they said, well, you don't want to lose your hair, Mum. So I thought, well, how important is it on the scale of do I want to live or do I want to lose my hair for a year? And so we discussed it, and then we decided we were going to make a really good event out of it. So my grandson, who was only 12 at the time, was he'd come home and say, Nana, have you lost any hair yet? The first lot of chemo wasn't that bad. It was like, really? That's not so bad. I can do this. But it was only the first dose. And then you're sort of slowly poisoning. You know, you get poisoned, which is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to clear out all the cancer in your body. But sadly, it clears out everything in your body. So your immune system collapses. And so you're quite vulnerable there for a while. And I got paranoid about the fact that, you know, that I might survive cancer and die of a cold. And one of the sad things that happened was that... in this painting, it symbolises, the upturned canoe symbolises the death of people. And as I said to you, we celebrate our funerals. It's one of our big events. When somebody dies in our community, we hold up for 3 days and we grieve with the family. And it's a time of sadness and fun and happiness and mourning and whanaungatanga, that relationship, sharing with people. And it's a whole feeling of love. One of my friends and confidants, who was a cousin of mine, she was younger than me. She found out she had cancer, but she had a month to live. They took her home to that village I showed you, and she was dying there. And her son came to visit her, and he was 18. He was just a wonderful boy. And he rolled his car and was killed, coming to see his mother. So she had to attend his funeral the week before she died. So it was like all this dreadful sadness. And then another friend of mine who was a wonderful composer, and he was bringing back all the old music, flute music, to prominence again, and his music playing was beautiful, and he died within a month. So at that stage I thought, there's a little plot here, and we're all being killed and we're all dying of these terrible diseases, and I don't know why, but it was just a time of our lives. But the other thing that happened too, which I found really quite strange, was that the fantails, which are beautiful birds in New Zealand, they're little cheeky little fantails, and they come and fly around, and they're just fabulous little birds. And my mother was always scared of them, and she used to say, "Oh, somebody's going to die, the fantail's in the house." And my father would say, "Oh, rubbish, that's a good luck symbol." When I first got diagnosed with cancer, I noticed that the birds were around all the time. The fantail particularly would just alight on a branch. And when I was doing chemo and I'd walk around the lake, because I used to think, I don't feel very well, I'm going to lie on the couch. And I thought, I could lie on the couch and feel really bad, or I could walk around the lake and get some endorphins into my system. And so I would go for a walk. Well, the fantails would be around me, and I'd think, but there are no trees. These fantails were constantly with me. And even the week before I left, I was at the clothesline putting washing on the line, so the line was like this. A fantail alit on the clothesline and was hanging on. And I couldn't believe that a bird would get that close, and especially a fantail. And it's been 5 years now, that they are still guardian symbols for me and they're still appearing.
In that third painting, symbols of death, the upside down canoe, and hope, the little guardian fantail birds. But in the last of the series, you begin to see the recovery. Mourning still shows, as does the need for protection, but hope and treasure dominate.
So this was the last painting in the series, and this whole series was cathartic. It was like, yay, got over that, you know. We have a treasure chest, which is called a waka huia. Waka is the canoe, and huia is the feather, which denotes the leadership and the power. So we have these little beautiful carved chests, which, and they're only small, but a lot of people collect, a lot of art collectors collect these waka huia. So you've got the two manaia at the top there, whereas the two manaia there, and there's the top of the box, and the manaia there are hanging on to my hair is growing back. I've painted my hands into my paintings. I'm always hopeful that there's a palm reader in the audience who's going to say, oh, you're going to live a very long life and you're going to be happy and wealthy. You will travel. Anyway, I haven't met anybody yet that. So all these images in here, and this work is about the symbolism that's related to my art, who I am as a woman. It's related to my personal journey, but it was a way of actually getting it all out there for my children and for the legacy. This is my hospital number, which I put there, and that's my father's military number. So it's like, come on, Dad, I want you and your army to help me out with this, you know. This is a piece of weaving work that my grandmother did, and this is a little tiki that I wear, and it's called Te Uoro, and it belonged to Maggie Papakura, my grandmother. And these are the two little babies. When you've had chemo, it sort of shuts your womb down so you can't produce any more children. Not that I was at an age where I would have produced any more children, but it's always that loss, that bereft. As a mother, you always want to have children or grandchildren, so that was just an acknowledgement that there was going to be no more children. And the little manaia again. And so that was a series of four paintings that I did.
As June took her journey through breast cancer treatment, she dealt with the fears, pain, hopes, and losses through her art. The symbols are not hidden within the paintings like secrets waiting to be found by the vigilant interpreter. They are right out there, surrounding June, who is the central human figure at her various stages of the treatment. And now that the paintings are done, they've served their purpose.
The paintings have all sold. It sounds ridiculous, but I had no attachment to them. Once they had painted them, they were out of my life.
June Northcroft Grant has been declared cancer-free by her doctors, so much so that they don't even want to see her again, except as much as anyone else should get checkups. She survived physically. It was through her art and her symbolic expression of that journey that she dealt with the emotional side of cancer. You can view an image of all four paintings of the journey at spiritwrestler.com, or you can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org for directions to the images.
Oh, time gets us all. There was a day.
That's Art in Manila, our featured artist on the show, Artistic Inspiration, today's Yin Radio theme. Installment number two is called Slow Down. Like June Grant, our next artist has a story of art and illness and recovery. I ran across Rebecca York at the 2008 Renaissance Fair in Moscow, Idaho, just this past May. I was on a break from working the KRFP booth, selling gyros, as a fundraiser. Just running around to see the wares there at the Renaissance Fair, because it is the best show in the region, and I only had a few minutes to take it in. I was admiring these gorgeous, bright, really happy pieces made of glass and mirrors. They were mounted in windows and indoors, and they're perfect for working with the natural light in any space. The artist making these glass mosaics is Rebecca York. She asked me if I knew her story, and since I didn't, I turned on the recorder and I learned her story. It's a story of a forced slowdown. This installment is Rebecca's story as I heard it there live at the Ren Fair. If you're online, you can go to rimrockcreations.com while you're listening and see Rebecca's work. rimrockcreations.com. And just imagine being in an outdoor booth on a sunny day and talking to the creator of these pieces.
I did licensed home daycare for 18 years and foster care, and in May of 2003, mm-hmm. I ended up in emergency, not knowing what was wrong with me. Well, they couldn't find anything wrong, so I ended up going to my regular doctor again, and he ran a bunch of tests, and I had hepatitis C with level 4 liver disease. And, you know, I had no idea. Well, anyway, that was 2 weeks before my daughter was to graduate from U of I here mm-hmm. in interior design and architecture. Mm-hmm. She's my artist. And anyway.
And we can take care of customers.
Yeah, they're just looking.
I mean, okay. Just so you know, you can, anytime.
Yeah, if you need help, just let me know.
Okay.
So anyway, December of that year, I realized I was so sick those 6 months on the I was on interferon and ribavirin. I was so sick I couldn't do anything, but I remember it was Christmas, and I thought I've got to do something. So I started making mosaics. I saw it on HGTV. I saw them do a ball, and I thought, I can do that. I've got junk around here. So I started messing around, and my daughter opened them for Christmas, and my son-in-law, who's a Native American, I made him a really cool Native American eagle-like thing and with deer bone and all kinds of stuff on it, mixed media type thing. And my daughter convinced me I should share this. And so my birthday was January 12th of 2004. So she found out all the information. Like I say, she was going to school down here. So she gathered up all the information, had photos professionally taken of my gifts to them, and entered me into this show.
Oh, yeah.
So this is my fifth anniversary of my first show ever, first juried art show, and my first art piece ever sold. And that's how this started. And it's just strange.
Yeah.
How it all started. And it's, and then I remembered I had these windows out in my shed and decided to develop a way to work on the glass of old windows. And through trial and error, I finally did.
And that's beautiful. I mean,
that's my
really nice.
That's my made-up thing of it all. Mosaics are, you know,
well,
people do that. But
yeah, I mean, it's a mosaic.
Mosaic.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And so this is your you know, you can see all your creativity.
Yeah.
But it's not your... what you originally designed, it's unique.
No.
I mean, it is unique.
What
but
I really made
unique.
Up different. Yeah, this that's you won't see anywhere else, you know, is this. Yeah, or at least nothing
quite
like it. And
describe it to me, since we're also talking to people who can't see it.
Well, it's old wood-framed windows, and sometimes they have some history. Well, they all have history, but sometimes really known history. And I take stained glass and hand cut it, make up my own patterns, hand cut the stained glass, and mosaic it onto the old windows, and so that you can actually see through them.
Yeah.
So do you collect the glass?
Well, I started out with found objects, and then I found a traditional stained glass artist, and I buy her scraps. I still buy her scraps. But I buy big sheets of glass, too, now, because I want mega stuff. You know, I want big hair, and, you know, I do mermaids with long, flowing hair and stuff, so I want big, huge hunks of glass. So I do buy the big, huge sheets now.
Where do you find your inspiration? You have flowers, you have geometric patterns, you have the fish here.
I really don't know. I think of things that would be really cool, like an eternal aquarium, like a fighting fish that never dies, a beta fish that never dies.
Yeah.
Let's see. Eternal gardens. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think about the colors I want to use and maybe some kind of a theme, and I go from there. That's about it. Sometimes I'll jot down drawings of what I want to do and go from there. I haven't even done a lot of things I want to do still that I have drawings of, you know.
But how does it all relate also to your recovery? You said you had to do something.
Yeah, well, I've always been a go-getter, you know, and I was a single mom for years, so I ran a whole household and a daycare business and everything, and then I was knocked down where I couldn't do anything. And I guess it just kind of made me take a big long look or something, and I found this creativity within me that I never knew I had. I knew I was a little creative, but I never knew to this extent. And I don't think I'm any more special than anyone else, though. I think we all have something if we would just sit still long enough and be still long enough to see it.
But you were forced to sit
I was forced to, because I am stubborn, I guess. And I wouldn't have had time. I never would have had the time. Maybe not even the money, really, to get into this like I did. But it just kind of evolved, and it's come.
Is this what you do now?
This is what all I do. Yeah. This is it.
And how's your health?
My health is pretty good. It's getting better and better all the time. The chemotherapy I was on did me more damage than anything, of course. I have fibromyalgia, I have a lot of problems, but
you still have so much energy.
Well, it's getting better.
Yeah.
And I had a really low vitamin D deficiency, too, that was just found out. So I'm on mega doses of vitamin D now. This is my second dose. So that's helping a lot. But this is my passion now. I mean, this is. I just feel like I'm lucky to do this, and I would give it to people if I could.
What's your workshop space like?
It's a bedroom turned into a workshop, and then the next room I'm overtaking it to. So we have two other bedrooms that are being used for actual bedrooms, and two that are being turned into other things right now. But cool. Yeah, and I have a son still at home. I have a 28-year-old and a 17-year-old. She's gone, obviously, but my 17-year-old will be graduating next year. And when he's gone, his room is really big, and it has an outdoor entrance, and I'm going to make it into a gallery.
So you'll have a gallery there on site?
On site, and we live on acreage between St. Mary's and Harrison, and I'll have a place where people can come and see my stuff. Maybe I might teach classes. I might even have a retreat thing going on. We're thinking maybe a teepee and fire in the middle and a woman's retreat maybe. Mike has built a trail up our property, which will be done all the way up to the top by then. It's a biking or a hiking trail, so it would be an outing. And you can see lakes and rivers everywhere up there, you know. So that might be a long-term goal.
Cool.
You know, yeah. If I want to share that property,
if you want
that
to.
Space, that's we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well,
I'm glad to stumble across your story.
Thanks.
You can view Rebecca York's work again at rimrockcreations.com. Listening to Yin Radio, our theme, Artistic Inspiration. Installment number 3 is Homage to Ginevra Sloan. Ginevra Sloan has been an artist since childhood. That was a long time ago, before her hands were gnarled. She worked in large paintings and in woodcuts, although perhaps those descriptions are a bit too narrow. Ginevra has never been afraid to experiment. She would use photographs in the paintings, actually embedding them collage-like into her work, or lace, or fall leaves, or barn wood. Ginevra would go to Kinko's and make copies of the photos she used in her work, and behind the counter, Jenny Rodd would help her. Jenny, 30 years Ginevra's junior, studied the great artist's process and began to ask questions, because Jenny Rodd is an artist too. Jenny describes the development of their friendship.
And she would come in and have these things that she wanted to photocopy, or she would have little, she would have a picture of a print that she was copying to frame up to give to someone. And I'd say, you know, if we make these like this big, we can put magnet on them, and you have little refrigerator magnets, you can have a whole show of your, you know. And so I helped her make those, and then we got to know each other there that way, so... pretty much through Kinko's. And then she would, like, copy the bowl picture. She'd take a photograph of a doorknob, and then she would enlarge it and fit it into a painting somewhere where there was a doorknob. And I just thought, oh, well, that's pretty novel. I mean, I thought either paint or you, you know.
But you don't
mix them.
And she does both. Yeah.
And she does both, you know. And she's, like, 30 years older than me, and she's more inventive than I am. I mean...
The two women struck up a friendship around those visits to Kinko's. Ginevra offered Jenny advice about her work, and Jenny adopted some of Ginevra's painting collage techniques for her work. Eventually, they had a show together. It was a combination of Jenny's newer work and Ginevra's previously unreleased prints. So when Jenny was invited to do a piece for a Women Honoring Women art show, of course she stepped up. She did a piece honoring Ginevra Sloan. 19 women participated in the show, and the theme was Homage to Women Artists, and it was exhibited at Above the Rim Gallery in Moscow, Idaho, in spring of 2008. The artists were to work within a box. Each piece was contained in a box that framed, contained, or somehow became part of the work. Most of them were about the size of a silverware storage box displayed open and mounted on the wall. One actually was a silver box. At the show, Jenny talked about Ginevra, their friendship, and the piece that Jenny did to honor her.
You know, she was kind of like, I got her input on it, and she was like so honored. She was like, oh, I'm so honored that you would do this, and I can't believe you're so, you know.
Excellent.
And she said, oh, I wish I could do one for you. And I said, oh, you know.
Can she work at all anymore?
Not really.
You Environment can, or physical or both?
Both. And, I mean, you can see that her hands have been... they're pretty crippled up when she was still in the apartment. Right now she's in the nursing side, but when she was in the apartment, our women's caucus was doing trading cards. Yeah. And so we went over and we did some together, and it was real hard for her to scale down to that size because she's so used to working big and doing big things. It was amazing for me to watch because I realized how I adjust to that because it depends on what kind of a space I have to work in, what I do. And she always had that space, so she was used to working real big. So I'm like, just make one of your, draw one of your paintings here, only do it like this big. And she'd be like, I don't know how to. And so it was interesting, the images that she made then. She ended up having two heads with their little kissy lips coming out together, like that, you know. I mean, it was a real sweet image, but very unexpected when you look at the powerfulness of her other artwork. It's just...
Ginevra's ability to experiment is just part of the connection between the women. They think a lot alike, and they balance experimentation with analysis.
She kept copious notes on everything, and I said, yeah, you were so good about keeping notes on everything about, oh, this wood is for this, or that picture is for that. She said, well, that's because I would forget, you know, if I didn't. So,
but still, to be so precise, of artists is, you know, just kind of going with the flow.
Oh, right.
And I know all artists can't do that.
Right.
I mean, there's still quite a variety of personalities, but that's an illustration of being meticulous.
Yes. And it's like if anybody that you've talked to that was a student of hers at the time, or there's a couple of people, one in our church that her granddaughter was inspired by Ginevra, and she said, I saw, and she said, I went into her studio, and she had paint all over the walls, she had paint all over everything, and I just thought, that's what I want to do, I want to make art, you know. And so it's interesting that she also has that, you know, kind of ordering side as well.
You can't rein it in a little bit, how can you finish?
Right. Right, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a little ADD in all of us, but it really helps to be able to carry through. I mean, at some point, that's the difference, is you have to focus on something to finish it. So, you know, and that's probably why I get along so well with her, because I have that too. I mean, I have people that said, oh, you should have been a math teacher. I have a real analytical side to my, you know, I have a real strong analytical side, but then I also have my, like, woo-ha, you know, fly by the seat of my pants too, so...
Being friends, Jenny helped Ginevra move into a new apartment, downsizing from a barn studio to a retirement home at Good Sam. And downsizing requires you to get rid of stuff. Some of that stuff Jenny held on to, though. Old brushes, photos, barn wood, a worn wooden spoon, tools of the trade. So when the idea to honor Ginevra with an original art project came about, Jenny had Ginevra's own items to include in the work.
So she was trying to throw out, this was an old woodcut of hers, and so what I did was I cut the woodcut in half, and then I started to frame it with the box, and then I photographed her hands with the brushes and stuff, because what I've learned from her as an artist, or one thing that she did, was she would photograph things, bring it into Kinko's, copy them, and enlarge them, and go and fit them into her paintings. Like, she might do, like, a couple of branches from that plant or something, and then she would collage it into her painting. And so that's why I did that with this. I thought, well, you know, I've got some of her wood spoons. This is great to touch if you actually... That's just plain wood that's rubbed from, you know, rubbing the prints. You have the wood cut, you roll the paint on the surface, you lay the paper on it, and then you rub it so that you're pressing the ink from the high points onto the paper and stuff, and then peel it back up. And that's why that spoon is, that's, and this one too, is from just from rubbing the print. And, you know, I couldn't see her throwing those things out, and I just, it gave me an outlet for them, because otherwise I would have just kept them in, I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
And this is actually one of her etchings, which is what I was showing them.
One of her,
it's an etching.
Oh,
it's an etching plate.
Uh-huh.
And I have a few of those, and of course she was going to throw those out too. And so this one fit in there nicely, and this is an actual picture of her. We figured she was probably about in her 40s when that photo was taken in her studio. So I thought, you know, it was a kind of a nice depiction of her, kind of how her hands were, how she is now and how she was then, and a little bit of how the kind of images that she liked.
One artist honoring another, one friend honoring another. Jenny created a piece to honor Ginevra Sloan using cast-off objects that Ginevra used to create her art. And Jenny used techniques that she learned from Ginevra and pictures of Ginevra as a creator. It is indeed a shrine to friendship and to inspiration. Homage to Women Artists is on exhibit through August 30th at the Lewis Clark State College Center for Arts and History in downtown Lewiston, Idaho. And you can see images of the entire collection online, including Jenny Rod's piece titled Beneath Stately Sloan Manor at moscowcares.com. We're going to go straight to our last installment on this Yin Radio Artistic Inspiration Show. This is called A Mother's Inspiration. It features Rebecca Rod. Jenny Rod from the last installment has a sister who's also an artist. And I have some of her work, some of Rebecca Rod's work. She does raku pottery with a spiritual side. You can see the pottery at rrrpottery.com, and you might want to look at that now if you want a visual for this next piece. Installment number 4, the last in today's show on artistic inspiration, comes from Rebecca Rod's presentation at the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse from Mother's Day 2006. It's about inspiration, both artistic and spiritual.
But I was 33 years old and well beyond all grown up when I found another mother who transformed my life, rebirthing me in a big way. I'm referring, of course, to the Great Mother, the mother of all, that we sang about in our opening hymn. The Greek poet Homer praised her with a hymn of his own over 2,800 years ago. Mother of us all, the oldest of all, hard and splendid as rock, wherever there is that is of the land, it is she who nourishes it. It is the earth I sing. But this earth mother of Homer's time was preceded by a mother figure at least 20,000 years earlier, the mother of all mothers, whose nadir was in the Stone Age. Some of the earliest terms used to refer to her were woman mother, clan mother, or divine ancestor, because her greatness and her mystery was in giving birth, the newborn babies coming from her body alone, with no knowledge yet about the input of males in the process. A picture of one of the earliest images of the Great Mother is printed on the cover of your church bulletin this morning. Chances are you've seen her before. This carefully sculpted female figurine was found by an archaeologist in 1908 near the town of Willendorf, Austria. He named her after Venus, the Roman goddess of love and beauty, apparently as a bit of a joke, poking fun at her very un-Venus-like figure. But there she was, Venus of Willendorf, in all her fleshy glory, found beneath 9 archaeological layers near the Danube River. The latest study in 1990 of the site deposit there dates the figure to about 24 to 22,000 BCE. Which makes her indeed, as Homer sings, a very old and splendid piece of rock. Specifically, she is limestone, and surprisingly small for the greatness and significance that has come to be attributed to her. At her full 4 3/8 inches in height, she would fit quite comfortably into the palm of your hand, where the articulations of her sculpted body could be experienced and appreciated as directly as they were probably intended to be. And there is much detail carved into this small figure. The largeness of her breasts and belly are obvious, but there are dimples sculpted at her knees, small marks that indicate bracelets at her wrists, visibly carved vulva, dare I mention it in church, and her hair is very detailed, made up of 7 concentric carved bands that look like braids encircling her head. All this packed into a small 4 3/8 inch Stone Age sculpture, carved and etched probably with the shard of stone or bone for a tool. Her purpose really has only been guessed at by archaeologists and anthropologists, as is the case with many prehistoric artifacts. But over the last century, this small image has come to be regarded as representative of the archetypal Great Mother. Her shape and features symbolize sustenance, sexuality, and abundance, attributes that have not only been universally desired but required through the ages to ensure the survival and continuation of human life. Is she evidence of a Stone Age spiritual life? Or an icon that proves Paleolithic reverence for a female deity? Archaeology is fraught with conjecture concerning objects dug up in its digs. So one man's Playboy Venus can become another person's goddess in a more enlightened era. One thing is certain. Over the thousands of years since her own creation, this small earth mother has birthed a long line of descendant daughters, leaving a trail of shards that provide ample evidence of women's centrality in the creation and building up of major civilizations and cultures. Isis in Egypt, Ishtar in Babylonia, and Inanna, praised in stone in Mesopotamia with these words, "She in whom light appears, radiant one, guardian of all greatness, to my lady enfolded in beauty, sing praise." In the last few centuries BCE, the Great Mother continued to split and be split into Greek and Roman goddesses whose spheres of influence became more specialized. Agriculture, animal domestication, the arts, the home, religion, and other disciplines. And from them, we get the myths and stories of Demeter and Persephone, Artemis and Diana, Athena, Vesta, and so on. This splitting seems to have happened to her in other cultures and religions as well, so that today we indeed have many, many names for the scattered aspects of the Great Mother. My own imagination was captivated by the original one, though, the oldest and splendid as rock, mother of all. I gravitated to her early in her purest form, and the first clay goddess I made was a copy of the Venus of Willendorf. She became the breakthrough piece for my art and my spirituality, and this is how it happened. And I have her here on the altar. On the yellow paper there, she's a bit fragile, not been fired. So this is how it happened. The UI Women's Center, where I was spending my spare time between working at the library and taking clay classes in 1985, advertised a program where people were invited to come and share something they valued as a symbol for them. I decided to take my newly formed Venus figure with me, but first I needed to be able to articulate what it was about her that was so important to me. So I sat with her in my hand earlier that day and pondered her meaning. And it came to me in the form of a kind of poem, no less, which I can no longer find, but that went something like this. I am the creator, molding the clay, shaping the image that is myself. I am the image lying beneath layers, waiting to be recovered. And I am the archaeologist digging through layers, finding the image that is myself. I probably cannot fully relate to you what a huge aha moment that was for me. It was like time and space didn't exist, and I suddenly felt connected to something so much greater than myself. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had a purpose for being here, and it made all the difference in my life and art and spirituality. Some of you are familiar with my pottery and know that I have made my fair share of goddess figures, rattles, prayer bowls, and other spiritual tools over the years since then. My studio is littered with shards of pottery that I have broken purposefully and reassembled, and other pieces broken accidentally that I can't bring myself to throw away yet. I've also created larger sculptures like the one on the pedestal today that reflect a personal archaeology of brokenness and wholeness, self-discovery and empowerment. This particular one is called Many Names Call the One. And it is one, like Donna said, from my series I call Power Suits. It was hand-built from the bottom up with coils of terracotta clay melded together, smoothed and shaped with a metal rib. When it reached the leather hard stage, I incised the designs on it, which consist of over 150 names of goddesses and the cultures they came from. I carved lines down each side and drilled holes for the laces to make it look like you could put this power suit on. And what a support garment it would be with all the power of those goddesses surrounding you. I fired it in sawdust in a way similar to the primitive firings, in direct contact with the fuel, not knowing how it would survive. Once fired, I broke it intentionally and removed one of the pieces and re-oxidized that piece to take out the smoke. Then I glued the whole thing back together to emphasize the archaeological reference of the whole piece. I appreciate that the spirituality of my work has touched many lives outside my own. When I exhibit at art shows, some people are moved to tell me surprisingly personal stories of their own struggles or concerns about friends or family, and their own joys too. People recognize the language of art that comes from deep within. Look again at the image of the Great Mother in your bulletin. Now maybe you can understand why I spent so much time on this particular image this morning. This small but Great Mother has birthed and nurtured over 20 of the most important years of my life, not to mention the lives of many others beginning thousands of years ago. What do you see when you look at her? What has nurtured your adult life? Blessed be.
You can see Rebecca Rod's work at rrrpottery.com. Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show, Artistic Inspiration. You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Yin Radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. My gratitude to June Northcroft Grant, Rebecca York, Jennifer Rod, and Rebecca Rod for today's show. Music is from Art in Manila from the CD Set the Woods on Fire. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. This is Yin Radio. Until next week.